It's hard to imagine Christmas Eve without Silent Night. For most people, that familiar carol defines Christmas Eve. Candle in hand, not trying to squirm as you sit next to your little brother in the packed pew, knowing that the sooner you get out of church that night, the sooner you can go to bed, and the sooner you can wake up on Christmas morning. And as a Christmas Eve service draws to a close, the room darkens only to be transformed by the warming glow of flickering candles. And children's voices blend with those of grown-ups in singing that gentle, hope-filled carol. Just imagining that moment makes us want to sing it right now. But instead, I invite you to join me in speaking the words of that first verse of Silent Night. They're printed in your bulletin right below the sermon title. And so let's speak those words. Let's speak them in hushed tones, as if there were a sleeping baby in our midst. Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright. Round yon virgin, mother and child, holy infant so tender and mild, sleep in heavenly peace, sleep in heavenly peace. Heavenly peace. An existence that is heaven-like, heavenly. What you'd experience if you were shadowing God. Worry? No more. Anxiety? Doesn't exist. Pain? Gone. But right here in our lives, to experience heaven-like, heavenly peace, can we even imagine our world allowing that to happen? I mean, we know human nature. We can be thoughtful one moment, self-centered the next. Our good intentions can find themselves pushed aside because some other priority gets in the way, or we're too busy, or we just forget. And even as we whisper a prayer for heavenly peace in our lives, the peaceful stillness of that moment might be broken by thoughts of a long list of holiday-related tasks to be done, or leaves to rake, or a remembrance of long smoldering grievances against some family member or co-worker or neighbor. Our lives don't seem to encounter heavenly peace very often, do they? You may be familiar with a famous example of heaven-like, heavenly peace prevailing in our busy, self-righteous, instant gratification world. It happened on the first Christmas of World War I. It's the now famous Christmas truce between German and British armies opposing each other in the fields of Belgium. By December 24th, 1914, the fighting had been underway for about 5 months. A Smithsonian magazine article on the Christmas truce described how British troops noticed at dawn on Christmas Eve that the Germans had placed small Christmas trees along the parapets of their trenches. And slowly, parties of men from both sides began to venture toward the barbed wire that separated them until literally hundreds of each side were out in no man's land shaking hands. Now, Smithsonian reports that one common factor seemed to have been that the German-Saxon troops, universally regarded as easygoing, were most likely involved and had made the first approaches to their British counterparts. One shouted across the no man's land, "We are Saxons, you are Anglo-Saxons. What is there for us to fight about?" In one detailed eyewitness account that survives, although the account wasn't given until an interview in the 1960s, Lieutenant Johannes Niemann, a Saxon who served with the German 133rd, recalled that on that Christmas morning, the mist was slow to clear, and suddenly my orderly threw himself into my dugout to say that both the Germans and the Scottish soldiers had come out of their trenches and were fraternizing along the front. I grabbed my binoculars, and I looked cautiously over the parapet, and I saw the incredible sight of our soldiers exchanging cigarettes and schnapps and chocolate with the enemy. And later a Scottish soldier appeared with a football, soccer ball, which seemed to come out of nowhere. And a few minutes later, a real football match got underway. The Scots marked their goal mouth with their strange caps, and we did the same with ours. It was far from easy to play on that frozen ground, but we continued keeping rigorously to the rules, despite the fact that it lasted only an hour and we had no referee. In most places up and down the line in Belgium, it was accepted that the truce would be purely temporary. Men returned to their respective trenches at dusk, in some cases summoned back by flares, but for the most part, determined to preserve the peace until at least midnight. There was more singing, and at least one spot presents were exchanged. In the trenches occupied by the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, Captain Stockwell climbed up on the parapet, fired three shots into the air, and then put up a flag that said, "Merry Christmas." And at this, his opposite number, Hauptmann von Singer, appeared on the German parapet. And both officers bowed and saluted. Then von Singer also fired two shots into the air and went back into his trench. And the war was on again. But in the midst of that vicious war, a vision of heavenly peace was glimpsed, if only for little more than a day, and if only in one part of that wide-ranging war. Men were able to overlook differences, set aside disagreements, extend and receive words and gestures of respect and friendship. Literally and spiritually, they were able to rise up out of the muck of mud and the prison of pride and reach out in common humanity to those who had been and would be again perceived to be enemies. So what might it mean for us to declare our own ceasefire? What if we were to resolve to treat enemies as friends? And maybe enemies is too strong a word. Maybe there are individuals or institutions or even self-imposed pressures and expectations that get in our way, that hold us back. The lyrics of the carol offer a prayer that the precious infant would sleep in heavenly peace. Now, I realize that it's dangerous for a sermon to talk about sleeping. But imagine sleep as a metaphor. Metaphor for putting to rest the emotional ammunition that puts us on edge and keeps us in a fight or flight alert. What if we were to ask God for the courage and strength to put to rest resentments and suspicions and irritations and impatience, disappointments that cause us to pick at each other or even to fight with ourselves? Why couldn't we live as though heaven-like, heavenly peace already prevails in our lives? In the selection that we heard from the book of Isaiah this morning, the prophet envisioned how the world would be different as people allow God's Spirit to fill their hearts and guide their lives. You heard, everywhere in the land, righteousness and justice will be done. Because everyone will do what is right, there will be peace and security forever. God's people will be free from worries, their homes peaceful and safe. Now really, how could Isaiah write, because everyone will do what is right, there will be peace and security forever? How could he write that? Well, Isaiah was envisioning the ideal. He wasn't describing his situation or ours. I mean, we know all too well that everyone is not doing what is right. But what could happen if we strove to do that? Isaiah said, peace and security forever. Heaven-like, heavenly peace certainly isn't our reality most of the time, but let it be our aspiration. Let it be our hope. For this reason, God of heaven became flesh, so that in Jesus of Nazareth we could behold God in human form. In the example of Jesus, in the example Jesus gave us, we are urged to live as though heaven-like, heavenly peace prevails in our lives. Let it truly be our prayer that God's way will become our way on earth as it is in heaven. Amen.